So you can read this word. So I'm going to get
it.
We'll call the Committee on Environmental Natural Resources to work to order here Thursday, March 10th, 2011. Welcome, folks and members. We've got, I guess, a half a dozen bills and a presentation from the Minnesota Zoo, so we'd like to get going on time. We have senators waiting in the crowd for their bills. And first up, Senator Miller, at Senate File 567. And I believe, Senator Miller, you have a couple presenters or what? Welcome, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm here to talk about Senate File 567. This bill would establish a state trail pass policy for non-resident off-road vehicles and direct the DNR commissioner to make this process of securing an ORV sticker more customer-friendly for non-residents wishing to purchase one. State law already allows snowmobilers and ATVers this convenience, and I'm working with the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association to extend this service to those folks. Now, current law provides that Minnesota residents pay $30 for a three-year sticker or pass for the vehicle, but has no specific provision for non-residents. This bill provides the option for either an annual payment or a three-year pass for non-residents. And to further explain the bill, I have with me Mr. Bruce Gunderson, who's the president of the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association.
Mr. Gunderson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Bruce Gunderson. I am the current president of the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association. I live in Ramsey, Minnesota. And to further add to this, currently non-residents are treated the same as residents. You go to the DMV and register your vehicle. However, the DMV is only open 8 to 5 on weekdays, nothing on weekends, nothing on holidays. Enactment of this bill would change that and make that available to non-residents, the tourists coming into the state, so they could go to any DNR licensing agent and purchase their ORV sticker off hours, so to speak, or on weekends. Open to questions if you wish.
Members, any questions?
Mr. Chair, I do have an oral amendment that I'd like to just to bring the bill up to par here real quick, if I could offer that.
Senator Miller.
And it's very simple on, let's see, page 2, line 2.5. It just said, should say license agents, and then the commissioner, instead of may, we want to say the commissioner shall appoint.
Senator, we'll let Mr. Knopf take a look at that. And it's okay, there's not any place else in the bill. It's the only location in the bill, is that correct?
Yes, from what I understand, Mr. Chair, it is.
Senator Miller offers the amendment. Would you like to? I guess we can read it. I guess we don't really need to read it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment carries.
Thank you.
Any questions, members? Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, isn't the DMV currently issuing these licenses, and isn't this going to be more difficult for the DMV to process? And is there a fiscal note on this?
I would like to refer to Mr. Gunderson to answer the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, the DMV does currently handle this. However, they would continue to handle the resident portion of it. For instance, myself, I would go to the DMV still. But this applies to the non-residents. The non-residents could use the ELS system, the electronic licensing system, currently available through the DNR. It only moves that portion to the non-resident portion over.
And Mr. Chair, from what I understand, and Senator Kielash, that we're already doing this for the snowmobilers and the ATVers, so this would just be doing the same thing for the off-road vehicles as well.
Senator Kielash, Mr. Knopf's got some comments.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think what this is doing is it's charging a fee for non-residents to use our state trails and our grant and aid off-road vehicle trails. Under current law, if they're only in the state for less than 30 days and you're registered in another state or country, you don't need to get this. You don't need to have registration with the state of Minnesota. So what this does, it says if you're coming into the state on a temporary basis, but you're registered or you're from another state, you will have to buy this pass to operate on our trails, because currently you don't need to have an ORV sticker on your vehicle if you're just operating in the state for less than 30 days.
Okay. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, on that point, Mr. Knopf, I don't see any
same with ATV.
Anything in this bill that undoes the you can come here for 30 days piece that's in statute now.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, this is modeled after the way we do ATVs and the way we do snowmobiles, where you aren't required to get our sticker. But you're required, if you're going to operate on our trails, then you have to have this trail sticker, because you're exempt from the general registration requirement. But as long as you're not operating on state trails or state grant aid trails, you still wouldn't have to have any sticker.
I see. Okay.
But if you're going to operate it on our trails that have been paid for by the people who are purchasing the registration or the gas tax work, then we want you to pay for the trail sticker to operate on those. And we did the same. Snowmobiles was about 6 years ago, I think, we did this for snowmobiles, and 2 years ago for ATVs, the same type of provision. And snowmobiles now, though, everybody, I think, has to get it statewide. But.
And then, Mr. Chairman, one more question for Mr. Mueller. Can you tell us how much money is in the off-road vehicle account at this point?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I'll look that up, but to the point of a fiscal note on this bill, I did request one and it wasn't finished yet, but I saw some of the preliminary data. It's very small. It's like $8,000 a year they're anticipating coming in due to this out-of-state sticker. That would go into the off-highway vehicle account. There's some one-time cost for setting up this in the ELS system, so probably for the first couple of years it'd be a wash, but after that it'd be a net gain of revenue into the account. But I'll look up the money in the account right now.
And then my third question.
Yes.
On lines 13 and 14 on the first page, there's a sentence that says that the commissioner shall issue a pass upon application and payment of the fee. Is that common language making it sound like there would be no reason why the commissioner could not issue the pass? Would there ever be a circumstance where the commissioner would want to not issue a pass of this sort to somebody? Maybe somebody who'd come in previous years and done damage or something like that, where it would. Maybe we wouldn't want the guy to have the pass to get on the state trails?
Mr. Knopf.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, that is common that we use the word shall. I mean, if there are other authorities for the commissioner to withhold, that would be elsewhere in law if that's okay. The case. I'm not sure on this one if it's the case, but we do have, basically, a few years ago, the legislature passed some tougher penalties on all off-highway vehicles. And so under that, there is a chance that the commissioner could withhold it for a certain time, but that's under separate law. But this is pretty standard. Whenever we're issuing, like, game and fish licenses or licenses for vehicles like this, that we say shall issue.
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, right now the off-road vehicle account brings in about $46,000 per year in registration revenue, but they also get the small portion of the gas tax revenue of about $1 million per year. So that account spends, on average, a little over $1 million a year. So this would bring in $8,000 to that, so small increase.
Sinclair, any more questions from the committee? Senator Mueller.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 567 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
As amended.
As amended, yes.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Bill carries. Thank you, Senator Miller. Welcome, Senator Scheid. Senate File 172. And you have with you, I believe, a Luke Pappin, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chairman and Committee. Senate File 172 is the result of an email that I received from Mr. Pappin, who's a resident of Brooklyn Center and a constituent in Senate District 46 that I represent. Currently, and he'll tell you his story, but currently titles with a lien holder that's listed that are issued by the DMV are sent directly to the owner of the vehicle. The titles issued by the DNR for boats or ATVs, jet skis, etc., that have a lien holder listed are sent to the lien holder. And so Mr. Pappin suggested to me that it makes sense to have some consistency in how the state handles these titles. And I agree, and the DNR agrees as well, so here we are. It's my understanding that this came about because several years ago, the DNR was making some changes to watercraft titling at the same time that the motor vehicle titling law was being changed, and they weren't coordinated. So this conformity, I think, fits with efforts to streamline, and it's obviously a small item, but one that affected Mr. Pappin, and I'd like him to just be able to tell you. It's not a real long story.
Mr. Pappin, welcome to the committee. Please
Thank
identify
you.
Yourself. Thank you.
Luke Pappin, resident of Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. And I bought a boat approximately last May and applied for a loan because I was getting married at the time. And the lien holder was listed as Wells Fargo. Well, several months after I had gone and filed all the title paperwork and everything, I got a letter from Wells Fargo, the lien holder, stating that they had not received a lien notification on the watercraft. Well, so then I called the DMV, asked them, you know, I hadn't seen my title, what do I need to do? They said, well, boats are titled through the DNR, please call the DNR. I called the DNR, at which point they explained that they had mailed the title several months ago. I said, well, that's interesting, I never got the title, maybe got lost in the mail. You know, where did you mail it to? And they informed me they mailed it to Arizona. Well, not living in Arizona, I found that curious and asked why, and I was informed that lien holders, any titles with lien holders listed on them get mailed to the lien holder themselves. So I then called Wells Fargo back and got in, not a battle, I won't say, but a back and forth of, you have the title, no, I don't, yes, you do, and several rounds of confusion with Wells Fargo because they had lost that title somewhere in their paperwork and couldn't find a copy of it. Well, after several months of back and forth, they finally found that title, filed it appropriately, and said that, yes, we are listed as a lien holder. They had asked me, well, just to prove it, please send a copy of the title, which obviously I could not provide because I did not have the title. So it creates a lot of confusion and some discontinuity between the DNR and the DMV.
Questions from the members? This certainly seems to clean up the language in the statute then, Senator Scheid.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, there is an amendment, and I believe that...
We'll pass that out.
And it is a repealer, and someone in the DNR suggested that while we're at it, we might make the two... functions complement each other concerning the waiting period for issuing a new certificate of title. So apparently we used to have a waiting period for both the DMV and the DNR, a waiting period of 15 days. And at some point they took away that waiting period for the DMV, but this would likewise take it away for the DNR. And I think you may have a copy of the language that's repealed as well.
Senator Scheid, so you move the amendment?
Maybe
I'm sorry. That's
thank you.
Senator Higgins moved the amendment. Any further questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is in order. Is there any more description that you need?
No, Mr. Chairman, no.
To give to the committee. Any more members have any questions? Hearing none. Senator Scheid.
Chairman, I appreciate your support, and if Senator Higgins or...
Linda will take care of Linda.
Linda.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins moves Senate File 172 as amended and to go to Judiciary.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that we'll hear it there.
That's right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. There is. Thank
you very
much.
Committee, thank you.
Thank you.
Be careful giving him a gavel. I don't know.
Where's my sheet?
Yeah. He's a hockey player. I don't know.
I think we'll do it.
It's shorter.
Yeah, I can't walk.
Solomon was one. He
writes a new song. Okay.
Chair and members, I have before you Senate File 485, which refers to the beneficial use of wastewater and stormwater capital grants and demonstration projects. Members, what we're set out to do here is, the way I understand current law, there's three towns in the state of Minnesota that qualify for funds that we're talking about today. And those cities actually have, and the gentleman with me here today will correct me if I'm wrong, I guess, that those towns have ethanol plants that are within the city limits. And there are only three in the state of Minnesota that qualify for this fund. I understand these dollars are set aside for capital grants upon their application. And that's basically what we're here today to do. We'll be applying for some of those dollars, and I have folks here from the Blaine Hill City Administrator from the City of Morris, along with
Mick Miller.
Mick Miller from Denco, who is the owner of the ethanol plant in Morris. So I'll turn the mic over to Mr. Hill from the City of Morris.
Welcome, Mr. Hill. Go ahead and introduce yourself. And
my name is Blaine Hill. I'm the City Manager for the City of Morris. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you about this. It's a very interesting project in that a bill was passed to provide grant funding for a demonstration project to use sanitary sewer wastewater to offset the use of groundwater in ethanol production. And as the bill was written, it was written for plants that were within a mile and a half of the city limits. In the case of the City of Morris, and I did provide you a handout with some of the reasons for why we want this, along with that, is a map on the second page of the City of Morris, and I circled where the plant is located. It is actually located in the city limits, and I also provided a map that shows the plant set up, and I don't know if you all got colored maps, but on the colored maps, you should be able to see some infrastructure things in a blue circle on either side of the highway. Is a potential pond for retention of stormwater. It's an interesting project in the fact that our sanitary sewer wastewater ponds are actually about 2 miles from the plant. In order to get sanitary sewer wastewater from those plants or from those ponds, we would have to cross over a number of different infrastructure facilities, including two state highways, probably a railroad track, maybe another a road. And so it just turned out that it wasn't feasible for us to use sanitary sewer wastewater. What we did learn, though, in the process of looking at this is that stormwater would be a much better fit for us because our stormwater system actually crosses over within a couple blocks of where the ethanol plant is. When the RFP was released by MPCA for this grant project, we asked if we could use stormwater in lieu of sanitary sewer wastewater. But the law was written for wastewater, not for stormwater, and that's the whole reason why we're here. We believe that we have a project that we're interested in doing. There's a number of good reasons to do it, to include the production reasons for the ethanol plant, and I'm going to have the plant manager just talk a little bit about the production of that. But this will reduce the amount of groundwater that's used for the production of ethanol, and oddly enough, groundwater is the least interesting use of water for the plant because we have very hard water in our area. Stormwater is a much better use. Sanitary sewer wastewater is a much better use because there's less minerals and things in that water for the production of ethanol. Along with that, there would be less water used in the production of ethanol. There'd be less energy used in the production of ethanol because of what they have to do to the current groundwater to get it ready for production. And in the end, there'd be a better waste stream coming out of the plant. So as we looked at this, we thought it was a very interesting project. From a city standpoint, our interest is that we know that there's a permitting system that's currently in place to permit the discharge of stormwater into our streams and river system. Pomditer River is an impaired water, and there's probably going to be a lot of rules and regulations as to what you put into the river in the future. If we can divert groundwater that comes off of the streets, the yards, the parking lots, and all those different places over to the ethanol plant where they can store it and use it in the production, we think it's a win-win for everybody. And that's why we're here today. We're asking for support to allow stormwater to be used. And in the case of this bill, that's basically what we're doing. And I'll have Mick just explain really quick, you know, what their interest is from the plant standpoint.
Sure. Thanks, Blaine.
Mr. Miller, introduce yourself.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mick Miller, general manager of Denco 2, the ethanol facility in Morris, Minnesota. The ethanol plant has been there for some time now. It's really one of the first dry mill ethanol plants in the state of Minnesota, dating back to the early 90s. Today, the facility is a 25 million gallon per year facility, grinding about 8.5 million bushels of Minnesota corn. One of our obstacles is meeting the ongoing discharge limitations that these ethanol plants and other processing facilities have with respect to non-contact water. The water that we're talking about is basically we're utilizing well water, bringing it into the facility, purifying that well water for the process for non-contact water such as boiler and cooling tower makeup. As we purify that water, there's a reject stream similar to your softeners in your homes, and we're required to reject that water. That is rejected to surface water and under a NPDES permit with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Those restrictions and limitations on that water quality are becoming harder and harder to meet. What we're looking at doing is utilizing a better water quality coming into the facility. Our groundwater is very poor in the Morris area. It's about 2,200 for conductivity. Where stormwater will range from anywhere from 500 to 1,000 for conductivity. So anytime we can improve the incoming water quality for the plant, it means that we'll be much more efficient on many different levels, and Blaine touched on a lot of those, even on energy, utilizing less energy to produce a gallon of ethanol. So we're very interested in looking at this option. I think it will be become more and more popular for other processing facilities, not just ethanol plants, but because it is really, it's truly a green project to be able to utilize a better quality water and reduce the amount of groundwater that we're using. So we're really in favor of amending the bill to allow stormwater to be utilized in place of wastewater.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Any questions for our testifiers?
Mr. Chair, if I could ask Mr. Knopf a technical question, actually a financial question. It's been asked, is there a $500,000 cap on here? Is that how you read the legislation? Is do you know? If someone were to want to seek more, how would you go about doing that? I guess that'd be the question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you can see that in subdivision 2 on page 1, it says the agency shall award grants for up to 50% of the cost of pre-design and design capital projects that demonstrate the beneficial use. The maximum amount for a grant under this subdivision is $500,000. So that is the maximum grant under the program. If you wanted to, you could amend it to change that cap, or you could not withstand the appropriation from the cap if the cap is deemed insufficient.
So it is. So the question or the point is, it is possible to raise that. You'd have to show why you would want that. Obviously, is that correct?
But Mr. Chairman, you would have to do that in your bill. I think is what you'd want to do.
One second. We'll proceed this way, and if we choose to do something with an amendment, we'll look at it later. So,
okay. Any other questions, members? Hearing none, Senator Ingebretson.
I asked the committee Senate File 485, recommended to pass.
Okay. Ms. Senator Ingebretson asks that Senate File 485 move to pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. The ayes have it.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Members want to clarify this vote was to layover for a possible inclusion. Okay.
Should we take the vote?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Chairman, I think it might be more proper to retake the vote, since the vote was to send it to the floor.
I'm sorry. The vote was to send it to where? I'm sorry,
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Pappas is right. If you want, it would be better probably to retake the vote. So basically, somebody can move to reconsider the vote, and then you just withdraw that motion and put a new motion in.
Okay. Somebody move to reconsider the vote. Okay, it's been so moved to reconsider the vote for Senate File 485 to be sent over and added.
Just brought before you again. Just reconsider.
To reconsider. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The ayes have it.
So now, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson should withdraw his motion to send it to the floor to the Senate, and then he should make a motion to pass and die over for possible consideration in an omnibus bill.
Okay. You want to explain that again to him? So he withdraw, says it, right?
Withdraw.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Ingebretson can just say, I move what he said.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Would you restate that again, sir?
If you really want me to. Mr. Chairman, first of all, Senator Ingebretson, you should withdraw your motion.
I withdraw my motion.
And then the next one, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, is to make a motion that the bill pass and lie over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
That's correct. That's okay. My motion.
And it has been moved that Senate File 485 lie over for inclusion in an omnibus bill. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Thank you.
Don't screw up again.
Do it right.
You can't just say after you do. Oh, I meant this.
See, you think that's easy stuff.
I don't know about that.
Senator Gerlach,
can I ask a parlamentary question? I'm wondering.
Why don't you do that?
Why is it, Mr. Chairman, that when a bill is, when the intent is to lay over a bill for possible inclusion into an omnibus bill, why do we vote on that rather than just announce that it is laid over? Because what if we were to vote it down?
You could.
Saying that it would not be laid over?
You could vote it down.
Yeah. That's exactly.
And then it would be debt. Yeah. So you are.
Yeah. No, I don't have a problem with.
Okay. I just think it's good. Understand why we yeah. why we do that. If
I think
it's
that's a
later.
Fair way of handling things. And we've done things. I think you know as a committee here probably had about as many Democrat bills as we have Republican bills. So I think it's a fair way to do it. So.
It's only because Bach had all those bills the other night.
And he wasn't
Mr.
here,
Chair?
By the way.
He wasn't here, yeah.
Senator Saxon.
The last chairman of the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee never voted on anything.
I know he did.
He ain't here.
Senator Saxon, you're right. You're right, Senator.
Senator Verloc said everything was just put on the
That's right.
Right.
We're going to move ahead. The Minnesota Zoo is here for a presentation. And welcome, everybody. And I think maybe the critters are gone. Is that right?
What? I missed the critters?
You missed the critters. You missed a. Well, I'll let you explain what they were. I know one was a skunk. I'm gonna pass on the snake as to the actual description of the snake. But they were here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lee Emke. I'm the director of the Minnesota Zoo, and joining me at the table is Peggy Adelman, who is our CFO. And for those of you who did miss it earlier, we did have two of our animals from our Zoomobile program, a striped skunk and a bull snake, for information to the chair. Part of our program that takes animals and educators out to the community and the entire state. It reaches about 50,000 people a year and really provides a significant outreach for the Minnesota Zoo. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity today to here before you, and although the focus is on our upcoming budget, given the large number of new members on this committee, I thought I'd take the opportunity to do a quick overview of the Minnesota Zoo, what we're all about, and what we've been doing in the last couple of years. Our mission is quite straightforward. We exist to connect people, animals, and the natural world. And we are kind of an unusual state agency in that that is our primary goal. And we're also, I guess, unusual as a state agency in that the animals, obviously, that are in our care are a unique resource. Though we are a full state agency, we also are in partnership with a 501c3 nonprofit, the Minnesota Zoo Foundation, which raises private funds to support the zoo and its mission. And I'll talk more about how that partnership has evolved and become more and more important in our future. The zoo really has three core areas. We talk about the three legs of the stool. Obviously, everyone thinks of the zoo as a recreational opportunity, which we are, but we're also very deeply involved in conservation and probably primarily in education. The conservation work of our zoo has been internationally recognized as really progressive and leading in the world of zoos. We've been involved in saving tigers in Asia, wild horses in Mongolia, and trumpeter swans right here in Minnesota. We currently have a number of endangered species breeding programs that we participate in with zoos from around the country and around the world, 23 species survival plans currently. And as I mentioned, we also participate in field conservation activities throughout the world. But perhaps our most important role, and this is where the conservation and education really are linked, is the fact that we have so many visitors coming to the zoo and so many opportunities to reach people with messages about wildlife, about the natural world, and about conservation. And I think the little-known fact is that the Minnesota Zoo is the state's largest environmental learning center. We obviously serve schools and teachers, hundreds of thousands of them visiting us every year, some on informal field trips, but many more in formal courses that we offer at the zoo, in a wide variety of programs, many of which are linked to the curriculum of the schools so that we're actually augmenting the educational system as opposed to just providing a fun day out, which we're also a fun day out, which is the nice thing about it. We provide informal education to the kids and families who visit the zoo. We offer courses from toddlers on up to adults in a number of areas. Our zoo camp is actually something that's a profit center for the zoo. It helps us support our operations, but it's also extremely popular, especially with our members. And although many times you think of zoos as serving primarily younger children, we're reaching out to teens and to families and adults with a series of programs to get them to continue their interest in the zoo and the programs that we have there. Our Zoomobile is the program I mentioned earlier and who made a brief visit. It's one of our most successful outreach programs, again reaching about 50,000 people throughout the state. We try in a two-year cycle to reach just about every county in the state. I think this map, it's a little hard to read behind me, but if you look at the red dots, those are where the Zoomobile has visited, and it's managed to, in over the past 2 years. So we managed to reach almost every corner of this very large state. And the yellow dots represent areas where school groups have come to the zoo and spent time visiting us from their home communities. So although we're located in the Twin Cities area, many of our 1.3 million visitors do come from greater Minnesota, and so we truly do believe we're serving our role as a state zoo. Given the difficulty of funding field trips to the zoo, as budgets at the school districts have become tighter, we've developed a program called the Minnesota Zoo Safari, which has private underwriting, typically corporations, but also individuals, who pay the entire cost to bring, in some cases, the entire grade level of a school district to the zoo, where they receive the admission to the zoo, the transportation to the zoo, an education program at the zoo, a monorail ride, and a lunch. And we're happy to say that we've been doing this program for now 13 years for all of the public schools in St. Paul, but we're reaching out and now have communities throughout the state that are taking advantage of this program. And in a time when many institutions are seeing their school visitation drop, we've actually seen it increase in the last few years with the private support generated by the Safari program. The recreational offerings of the zoo are kind of self-evident. People come to zoos as family groups to have fun. But we also offer a number of additional things above and beyond the animal exhibits that augment that and that help us generate revenue. We have a concert series at the zoo that's always named the most popular outdoor concert venue in the Twin Cities. And we do all kinds of public and private events using our facility as a venue. And I think if you look at it in total, the educational work that we're doing, the recreational activity, it all adds up. We are providing a pretty significant benefit to the state. The last time we did an economic impact study was 2 years ago, and it said that we're generating $114 million worth of direct and indirect benefit for the state by operating the zoo. This does not even include the impact of the many construction projects that we've had at the zoo in recent years, and that would certainly add to this total. And I guess the other thing that we're pleased about is that in a period of economic recession, the last 3 years, our impact has actually increased by well over $20 million from the last time we measured it. So we believe we're not only serving the state from the mission perspective of education and conservation, but the economic impact of having a great zoo is also pretty critical. A few years ago, we set out to restate what our zoo should be, and the board, our board determined that we should become and become known as one of America's top 10 zoos. This was about 5 years ago that we adopted this goal. There is no formal poll or formal rating system for zoos, but in informal rating systems that we have seen in a number of cases, we're now popping up in the top 10 list pretty frequently. The changes and improvements to the zoo are really making a difference. I think that goes to our history. We're still called the new zoo by a lot of people, but we're now 33 years old. But I think we're now really starting to hit our stride, and that original vision for having a world-class zoo in Minnesota, I think we're getting there. And just in the past 10 years, we've really seen a significant amount of growth with new exhibits and new programs, and I'll just quickly run through, starting back in 2000 with the Wells Fargo Family Farm, new tiger exhibits, new exhibits in our tropics building, bringing a butterfly exhibit to the zoo, bringing Africa to the zoo on a temporary basis, redoing the Minnesota Trail, Russia's Grizzly Coast, and most just this past summer, Faces of the African Forest. All new exhibits that generate interest and repeat visitation and help us get our message across in a better way. But we don't just build exhibits to build exhibits. We're doing it to make connections. We're trying to get people closer to animals, to have more conservation messages made available to more people. But we also do it in a very deliberate way. We don't just open exhibits because we know they cost more money. Every time we open a new facility, the operational costs go up. So each of the exhibits that I just mentioned is preceded by a very detailed pro forma business plan. We look to make sure that we're going to generate at least as much revenue as the new cost of the new exhibits as we're going online, which sometimes means making choices and actually closing existing exhibits that aren't functioning that well so that we can save those operational dollars and use them towards our new exhibits. I think it's important to recognize that the zoo, although we're a state agency, we operate as a business. And the results have been really great the last couple of years. These are the last two full fiscal years at the zoo, over 1.3 million people visiting each year, the all-time numbers for our zoo. This year we're a little bit down. We know the weather's impacted it. We also know that Russia's Grizzly Coast, which was our big exhibit that opened 2 years ago, you get a certain bump from those big blockbusters, and now we're seeing it settle down a little bit. But we're excited, as I'll show you in a minute, about some new exhibits coming online that we think will continue the really significant progress in terms of our overall attendance. With the success of the zoo, we've also been able to reach out and create more partnerships with the Minnesota corporate community and with individuals who want to support the zoo through the Minnesota Zoo Foundation. This is just a sampling of some of our corporate partners, many of whom have only come on in recent years as they've seen the zoo grow and become successful, and they're realizing they'd like to get on the bandwagon and be part of it, part of a success story. And I think this chart really demonstrates something that's important, especially on a day when targets were announced for budget reductions and the like. When the zoo first started out back in the 80s, we were primarily dependent on the state for our operating budget. At one time, it was about 60% of our operating budget came from the state appropriation. It's gone down pretty consistently over time, and we're now down to 29%. The rest of it we're either earning at the gate or through our revenue programs or are coming in as contributions to the Minnesota Zoo Foundation. And I think the other interesting fact is that if you look nationally at all the zoos, all the aquariums, which have many different operating models, on average they receive about 40% of their operating support from a public source. And we as a state agency are actually now operating at a much lower level of taxpayer dollars and the rest that that we're finding ways to essentially generate ourselves. Much of our recent success has been due to capital reinvestment in the zoo. The bonding bill from the state, together with private donations, have allowed us to build exhibits like Russia's Grizzly Coast that I think have really demonstrated that we can spend the money well and the return is strong. Our attendance really speaks to that. The visitor satisfaction numbers are all very clear. But as we've done that, we've come to realize that we still have a number of things to fix. If you look at our front door here, this image is what, a world-class zoo, but if you took the sign that said Minnesota Zoo off of that, I'm not sure you'd know what kind of facility you were going into, and I'm not sure you'd want to go into it. It was a lot of concrete back in the 70s, and we were kind of built at the wrong time in the history of American architecture, I'm afraid, at least the initial building. And beyond the aesthetics, there's also systems are really old and need to be replaced, and we're looking at public safety with paving, heaving, and the like. So we're looking at how can we redevelop this now 33-year-old zoo in a way that takes advantage of the bones that are there, but improve the visitor experience and allow us to more economically operate. And the project that's dealing with that is something we're calling the Heart of the Zoo. This will be the new entrance to the zoo that will be opening up this summer. It's essentially the same angle as the previous photo of the concrete bunker. But we want to welcome people and immediately get them engaged in our mission of connecting them with nature, making it much more comfortable for everyone. We're building a large environmental education center with classrooms that will allow us to serve more school groups and more of our educational audiences. Major donation by Cargill is supporting this, as well as the bonding bill from a few years ago. We're converting what used to be the old beluga whale tank at the zoo, which has been sitting empty for 15 years, into a new indoor space called the Target Learning Center that'll be a home to our bird show and to many performances and community events in a wonderful new space again, a public-private partnership between the bonding bill of last year and Target, who made a $1 million donation to support this project. The highlight of the Heart of the Zoo project, phase one that will be opening up this summer, is a new penguin exhibit, the penguins of the African coast. And yet again, we found a major Minnesota partner here. 3M made a gift of approaching $2 million to name this exhibit and to support our education programs. So all of this, the Heart of the Zoo, will be opening up this summer, and I invite you all to come out. If you haven't had a chance to see the other improvements, this is really going to take us up, we think, to yet another level. So we've been working hard to provide a great zoo for Minnesota. But I think a few years ago, it was a different story. Back in 1998, the legislature and the governor really challenged the zoo because the zoo at that point was not working. Promises were being made and not kept. And, but since that time and since the governance study that was conducted in 98, we believe we've met and exceeded the challenge put before us. And again, I'll go back to that fact that today, only 29% of our operating budget comes from the state, down from the 60% level that was there before. We're operating as a business, albeit one with a strong mission focus, and we're always continually working to improve our efficiency and effectiveness. Although the zoo's really grown in the last 10 years, our full-time employee count has grown at a much slower rate than the other growth indicators. We currently have 231 FTEs at the zoo, but only 42% of those are funded out of the general fund. It used to be about 70%. So again, we're seeing the mix of funding to the zoo really changing from being primarily public to primarily private. We're aggressively pursuing efficiencies, whether it's energy use, water use, general operational practices. We're working hard to make sure we're running a very lean ship. The foundation, the Zoo Foundation, used to provide about $900,000 a year to the zoo to help us with our operating budget. That's been more than doubled in the last 4 years. They now provide $1.9 million on an annual basis to help us with our operations. I mentioned the cost-benefit analysis that we do with every new exhibit. We're making sure that the new revenues are going to at least match the new expenses anytime we build a new facility. So, with that, I kind of wanted to get into the numbers and talk about the budget and some of the scenarios that we're all looking at moving ahead. But just to kind of underscore the point about the declining level of state support, just in the last biennium, our base budget from the state appropriation declined by 13%. So, you know, what is the base is always the question, but I think we've already shown that we've been responsive to the cuts that were made in the past biennium, but it does set us up for maybe a more difficult road moving into the next round of cuts. The governor's recommendation was a 5% reduction, which equals about $312,000 each year. That is a number that we've looked at, and we think we could bear that with a combination of new revenues, some increases in the contributions through our foundation, but also some cost savings. We probably will close our – in fact, we've already made the decision to close our butterfly exhibit and recoup the costs of doing that this year. We think this year, because we have a new penguin exhibit coming online and the Target Learning Center, we'll still be offering our guests a great value, but I know that this is an exhibit that will be missed. In addition, we're doing some restructuring. Some of this restructuring was made possible by the early retirement incentive that was offered by the legislature last year. So we will be cutting staffing costs as well in order to meet a 5% reduction target. But obviously, that's the governor's recommendation, and there are a number of other scenarios out there. We've been thinking about it really since last summer when MMB asked all state agencies to prepare scenarios for a 10% reduction or 15%. For us, 15% is nearly $1 million each year in the biennium. And our response to cuts of that level would obviously include all the things that we're doing for a 5% cut, but we would probably have to look pretty seriously at closing one of the major exhibits at the zoo. We've looked at the idea of kind of cutting every part of our operation. We realize that our accreditation with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums would probably be threatened if we actually went to that, because we're running at really a very thin margin now on everything that we do. So instead of compromising everything, we would look at one of our major trails, whether it's our marine mammal exhibit, the Northern Trail, the Minnesota Trail. We haven't made those decisions yet. But $1 million cut in our operations at this point would probably require us to look at something more than just a superficial cut or, you know, kind of cutting around the edges. But before we look at cuts, we obviously look at revenue. We would challenge our foundation to raise more money to help support the zoo, but the current economic conditions, you know, philanthropic giving is not bursting through the roof any more than the state budget is. But we'll certainly give it a shot, and we, again, have a good track record going into the year that we think we might be able to raise more money privately. It's important to remember, however, that most of private funders, corporations, foundations, and individuals are interested in funding specific programs or specific exhibits and generally are not interested in funding essentially, you know, general operating costs. So that will be a challenge going forward to backfill state general fund support with private funding. We've looked at the cost-cutting exercises. We think cost-cutting at 15% or more will certainly diminish the product that we can offer our guests. Zoos and aquariums have high fixed costs. They're staff-intensive. We have obligations with our animal collection to 365-day-a-year, 24-hour care. Very, you know, complicated, fail-safe environmental systems that need to be maintained by specialists. So it's not an easy task to find cuts after we've been economizing over the last many years. About 70% of the zoo's expenses are salaries and benefits. And the remaining big expenses are the utilities and supplies, the animal food and the heat and cooling of our exhibits. So we really have only one option if our budget is cut significantly, and that's to make major reductions in the animal collection. Once we do that, we're actually eliminating exhibits that the public is already used to seeing at our zoo, and we believe that if that happens, we're going to see our attendance start to decline, and we'll get into a cycle that's going to be a little hard to climb out of. We're worried about the impact if we're maintaining our pricing level but offering less. It will be difficult to continue the attendance growth that we've seen. So obviously, I guess the last point I'd make about closing exhibits is that because many of them are partnerships with individuals or corporations, it becomes problematic from a fundraising perspective. If you think about major donors who've made a major commitment, they're seeing the benefits of their support being eliminated, it's going to be hard to bring them back to the table for additional gifts in the future. So I guess in the end, we're concerned about a downsizing direction after many years of real growth and progress. I think the downsizing would be difficult for the 1.2, 1.3 million people a year who visit our zoo, difficult for the 42,000 member households of the zoo and to the growing roster of donors that we have. And again, this is particularly in light of the really positive forward momentum that we've generated in recent years. I would add that, you know, over the past decade, we've significantly reduced our reliance on state operating support. But if we continue to absorb cuts in the 10, 15, 20% level, it's going to be very hard to regain the momentum that we're currently experiencing. We certainly understand the magnitude of the budgetary gap that the state is facing, the difficult choices you will all be making over the next session, but we'd ask that you consider the zoo's recent performance and kind of the 180-degree turnaround that we've been able to make in our funding model over the past decade as you make your decisions. Thank you.
Members, any questions? Senator Gosh.
Mr. Chair, do you have a breakdown of visitors that are coming from out of state? In other words, tourists coming in to visit the zoo? Give us a breakdown on that.
Mr. Chair, Rampy. Senator, I can't give you the exact breakdown of out-of-state visitors. We know that of the 1.2 million guests, about a quarter of them are from either greater Minnesota or beyond. So we do attract from Iowa and Wisconsin, obviously. think the tourist visitation to the zoo at this point is relatively low. But one of the things, as we develop a facility that's world-class, we think we have the opportunity to become a tourist destination well. But we are currently, it's about a quarter of our total visitation coming from outside the 7th Metro.
Mr. Lempke, to that point, to Senator Kielash's point, can you tell me about how many outstate residents you connect with your tour? Maybe you said that. I didn't recall it.
Mr. Chair, again, the Zoomobile program, which is our outreach effort, reaches about 50,000 individuals throughout the year, and I'm just hazarding a guess that about half of them are, again, outside the 7-county metro.
Okay. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hemke, this has got to be about, is it 10 years you've been the director now? Is that right? Is it the 10th anniversary?
Correct.
A long time. I was going to say that I've said this privately to a lot of folks and also publicly, but you touched on a little bit about the turnaround. And there's a lot of members who don't know, but you kind of glossed over it, but you should know about some of the turbulent times that the Minnesota Zoo has gone through. And my first term when I was elected, I was in the House, and there was, at that time, the zoo had deficiency requests in all the time in the red ink and needing that January bailout of emergency funds all the time. And there was, and you touched on it, about the foundation. You know, it's easy to raise money for sexy capital investment projects, but it's not so easy to raise money for the operating costs. And the balance had been really out of skew on that, and also the attendance projections. And there were newspaper stories all the time about the troubles going on there. And that's at the time where you took a chance and came in. And the legislature was pretty harsh on the Minnesota Zoo at that time as well, questioning those deficiencies and calling for the governance study, which was, do we even have the proper model of governance here if things are like this? And you came in, it was 10 years ago, and we asked you to do some things. We asked you to run it more like a business, to get things under control, and you've talked about some of those things. At that time, I didn't represent the zoo. Actually, it was in the neighboring district. Now, for the last number of years, I have represented the zoo, and I've watched closely as things have really turned around. And we don't see the deficiency request. In fact, when is the last time the zoo has been to the legislature for a deficiency request outside of the normal budgeting? Do we have an answer to that, or do we know that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, I believe the last time was in 1998, which was what triggered the governance study that you referenced. I think the deficiency study or the deficiency appropriation was granted on the condition that that study be conducted. The study out 10 major points about where the zoo needed to improve its relationship with the legislature, its private fundraising, creating a long-term vision and acting on it, increasing its educational opportunities. And I think we've been able to I don't want to say check off, but make real progress on all 10 of those recommendations. And I think the results are speaking for themselves.
And that was a real fork in the road, really. And I'm pleased to say that you've been on the right track of that, on that fork for the last years. And I myself have been very critical in those early years as well. I was a proponent of that governance study. And now I will say that it's you've done what we've asked you to do. So for that, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Peggy Adelman, Chief Financial Officer at the Minnesota Zoo. Just a little bit about our structure. Mr. Emke reports to a board of directors, and half of the board are appointed by the governor, half are appointed by the board itself through a governance committee. There is a finance committee, and at the time of the deficiency, they said, we never want to do that again. And because the state's fiscal year doesn't really coincide with the zoo's business operation. The fiscal year ends right in the middle of our busy season. And so if we are at the end of a fiscal year and it rains every weekend in June, we're out of luck if we haven't put aside a contingency to take care of that. And so we have a very conservative finance committee, which I like, made up of auditors and accountants and small business owners that meets on a quarterly basis Our budgeting all goes through that committee, and I think that that has helped, and you've got those outside eyes that are looking and helping us look at the business operation of the zoo.
Members, any questions? Senator Hall.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just want to state my family and I went out there about 20 years ago when we moved into the area, and we were impressed then. We went out there this year again, and it looked like it was about double what it was 20 years ago, and I don't know if it is, but I was really impressed getting a little bit behind the scenes with how organized and how much effort is put in to the, you know, from the front end, you just see the fluff, how good it is and the quality is, but behind the scenes, you have a real friendly workers back there that were just great to talk to, and really respect them and appreciate them. And also, if I'm not mistaken, did I hear that your male dolphin died? Is that something I heard lately? No, it wasn't you?
Mr. Chair, it was not the male dolphin. It was the elder female dolphin.
The elder female, okay. Just checking. Will that dolphin be replaced then, or how does that work?
Oh, Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, we get into what I call dolphin politics.
Oh, okay. I won't go there. We have enough here.
Dolphins
all
are
to
very
say
popular
thank you for
animals.
What you do.
And we work with other zoos and aquariums that sure. have dolphins. People put a lot of energy into dolphins and the training, and so it's not easy for another organization to give up one of their dolphins, but it's something that we're constantly working on.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Well, I for one, Senator Hall, have visited this facility several times with my grandchildren, and I'm always impressed with the amount of activities and how clean the facility is. And to Senator Gerlach's point here, how the turnaround with regards to the state funds versus the amount of revenue being brought in. That's quite a turnaround, and the foundation dollars as well as the donated dollars. So you folks have certainly done what it's taken to keep going, keep moving along, and we're coming into some times now that are going to be very challenging for everybody, and I'm sure you know that, and hopefully we can continue to put out the same quality of product that you have in the past. So.
One last thing, Mr. Chairman. I will have to say that I shied away from having for the photo op with the skunk because I didn't want the newspaper to show the headline.
I can already see the headline.
And then me picture holding a skunk. So I want to keep the two separate.
And thank you again so much for bringing the critter. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to mention that we have a spring break coming up, and it coincides with the time when the farm animals are giving birth. Ooh. So it's a really nice time to take your grandchildren and your children.
Very good. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, as long as Senator Pappas is helping us with our marketing campaign, for those of you who were not able to be here when we had our Zoomobile animals, you should have recently received or will receive a postcard. We have Zoo Day at the Capitol. Every year we bring many more of our Zoomobile animals into the rotunda, and that is March 24th. We'll be there from noon until 1:30. So please, between committees, stop by and pet a chinchilla.
We always appreciate the visit. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for the presentation.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Moving on, next we have Senator Limmer. Senator Limmer with Senate File 333 with regards to the Dayton Mississippi River Management Plan. I believe along with Senator Limmer, we have Ms. Orduno and Stora. Is that correct, Senator Limmer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 333 may be familiar to a number of our previous members. Last year, we presented the same bill. It was included in an omnibus bill, and then the omnibus bill was waylaid. It never got to a Senate vote. You may recall that the city of Dayton lies in the northwest end or northern end of Hennepin County, It's at one time it used to be a township, but prior to the township, a little outpost on the Mississippi River at the confluence of the Crow River was a village of Dayton. And it was used for it actually preceded the Civil War. And it was a landing spot for boats traveling up and down the river, as well as a place where I think logging was stalled. If people don't know the city of Dayton, it is now a suburb, and still very, very much undeveloped. But the old village of Dayton covers a number of homes. I can't remember how many right now. I know our city people will fill you in on that. It has a boat landing right at the confluence of the Crow River. And yet at the same time, we find that it was part of the Wild Scenic and Recreational River rules. And most people don't realize this, but there is a old commercial buildings in the city, a little main street even. And most of those buildings are still remaining vacant because they cannot develop it commercially. The committee managed to see to it last year that they accepted the Dayton plan, but since we never got to a full Senate vote, we're back again. I have representatives from the city of Dayton that would like to make a small presentation.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Samantha Orduno, and I am the city administrator. And Aaron Stawara is the assistant to the city administrator, city planner, the community development director. She wears many, many hats. Thank you very much for hearing this. This is very important to the city of Dayton. We are a small city, but we are almost 30 square miles. We are a growth-oriented Hennepin County city that when this economy turns around, we are going to be the place that you're going to see some major developments, housing developments. We are on the Botineau Corridor, which is County Road 81. But our village is up the corner. And if you're ever driving on Highway 10 and you see that great big steeple as you exit Anoka, and on the south side, you will see this large steeple. That is the St. Baptist, John the Baptist Church in the village. And the village is a very historic, very quaint area that has such enormous potential. I'm going to pass around our historic village framework, and then I'm going to turn it over to Erin because she has been working diligently with the rulemaking on the Mississippi River Critical Areas study, and getting the opportunity to redevelop this historic village is both meaningful for the community and the historic aspect of it, but also the economy of the community, because we're a very unique community in that we are going to develop from the outside corners in, and one-third of the city is the Elm Creek Park Preserve. So we could get that passed around. I will turn it over to Aaron with your permission, and thank you very much.
Stora, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Just to give you a little background, a little further background on this particular portion of the city of Dayton and our relationship with the river rules, Dayton is part of the Wild and Scenic River area as well as the Critical Corridor area. We are the first city coming from the north in the Critical Corridor area, and only one of two cities in that Critical Corridor area that has a dual level of regulation that includes the Wild and Scenic Standards. Wild and Scenic Standards only allow for single-family residential and peripheral uses related to that. Therefore, this particular section of our community, which houses a city fire station, our senior center, a post office, a restaurant, all which have been grandfathered in at this point, none of those uses could be expanded, and no additional commercial could be built in that area due to those regulations. This bill you have before you today would allow for commercial uses, mixed uses, apartment uses, those types of things, even expanded public use of property in this area With use of shoreland standard regulations, very similar to what Hastings follows, instead of disallowing all but single-family residential development. Most of the property in the Dayton's Historic Village is over 100 years old. Samantha mentioned St. John the Baptist Church. That is a historical building. I do not know at this time that they have any plans to expand their site. But as Dayton grows, I would imagine the pressure on that church community would grow with it. But we do not have an opportunity to really plan forward without this change. We also struggle with the fact that the city had made a very big investment in municipal sewer and water in this area about 10 years ago. We have most of the properties connected, and as mentioned, most of the properties are very aged. Those aged properties, in most cases, are blighted properties, some homes that are in very big disrepair that I don't know unless somebody bought an entire block's worth of property being platted back in the late 1800s where you had 30-foot wide lots that were 100-foot deep. You'd have to acquire several properties to make even a single-family home site redevelopable for that sole purpose. So we look to you for any comments. We're here with any questions. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? I have one with regards to the this excludes marinas, correct? And they have to follow a different governing rules. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I understand you've worked this out with the DNR. Is that correct?
Yes. Based on discussions I have had in the past with the DNR, there have been some items that were left out of Executive Order 7919, which monitors the critical area, and then the wild and scenic standards as it pertains to Dayton. I believe that was an oversight in the past, and this would correct that oversight. So Dayton would be treated the very same way Hastings is treated, because their villages are their historic areas are very similar.
Members, any questions? Senator Kulash.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who this should go to, but is this a historic area that would qualify for historic preservation tax credits if the building's redone? Are we talking about all new construction?
Mr. Chair, members of the Senate, and the Senate Committee, there are many buildings that are over 100 years old, but a very few would probably qualify for historic preservation. Some of the buildings are in poor shape. A lot of it would be new construction, redevelopment, bringing in some commercial. We do have a lot of senior citizens in the area. This is the original part of the community. It was at one time an old logging facility and mill. So as we move forward with redevelopment, it would be redevelopment. We would keep as many of the old buildings as we could, but it would probably be new development.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Senator Hall, would you move the bill?
Yes. I would move Senate File 333.
Would be recommended to pass.
To recommend to pass.
And
thank you.
Possibly held over the inclusion of the omnibus bill.
And it would be possibly the.
All in favor? I'm sorry.
Thank you.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Curious. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Hall.
Yes.
Senator Gazelka, Senate File 304.
Thank you, Senator Hall. You guys just giving it to me today.
Members, this is a memorial bridge designation.
You should give it to him, Norm. Give up with about 100 questions.
I might say we're right on track to be out of here by 9. In 9 minutes. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
9 minutes, right.
Got some long evenings this week.
I can't go back till tomorrow morning. I've got to be in Brainerd. Is it just the
Senator Gazelka, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is related to Terry McGaughey. He passed away recently. He was a legend in the bike trail community across the state. We have a bike trail bridge that crosses one of the community streets in the Brainerd-Baxter area. I was approached by some to actually rename the Paul Bunyan Trail the Terry McGaughey Trail. I said, I don't think you want to go that far. Talked to the Chamber of Commerce, and they said that would not be the right step, but perhaps we would consider naming the bridge after him. I have in your packets are being handed out just two articles. One of them is from the Star and Tribune. You know, so he was recognized as far as the Twin Cities as Mr. Paul Bunyan Trail. For those of you that have not been on the Paul Bunyan Trail, it's 110 miles of tarred trail from Brainerd to Bemidji. I believe it's still the longest tarred trail in the state. Much of it travels not alongside highways, but along lakes and through the woods. It's my family bikes and walks and rollerblades on there. It's a phenomenal trail. I did ask I asked for a fiscal note, and they said it's not measurable. I don't know if that means that it's because they want to do it, or I don't know. But just want to let you know that's where that is. But that's the bill.
Senator Gazelka, I understand the DNR will absorb that. Basically, I think that's what it's meant by that. So
yeah.
There'd be no fiscal implications whatsoever. Any questions from the committee? Senator Gazelka, is this a you said it was a long-time member of the community there?
Yeah, in fact, I believe 40 years, but the last 25 years of his life he spent advocating for this trail. And frankly, he'd share his information with anybody, Mr. Chair. He helped on the Crosby bike trails and probably bike trails in different parts of the state.
Members, any questions? Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 304 be passed and
possible inclusion
in the omnibus bill.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you, members.
Members, one more bill.
You were control. This one's going to take a while. You were control.
Yeah.
Hey, Hall, get it right this time.
Get it right now.
That's how you do it.
Chris.
I just think I've been asking him a lot of questions just to hear. He kept us here until I used the other night for Jeff.
Except I
want to
get out
of
here.
Yeah, I know. I got the same thing.
Please, so.
Member, Senate File 358 is a removal of Beavers piece of legislation. And with me today is Mr. Solem from the Township Township Association, State Township Association. This was brought to me by them, and there's been consultation with the DNR. I understand there's an amendment we'd like to offer at this time to get the bill in order. That would be the A2 amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Everybody have the amendment? Okay. Senator Retson, do you want to speak to that?
Yes, I move that the A2 amendment, the delete all amendment, this time.
Okay, the A2 amendment been moved. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay? The ayes have it. We will go on the A2 amendment.
That, Mr. Chair and members, I'll turn it over to the representative from the Township Association, Mr. Solem, for comments.
Mr. Solem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kent Sulem, General Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships. Thank you for your time today and consideration of this bill. It may be familiar to many of you. It was in last year's omnibus bill that was vetoed by the governor, but not for this purpose. This was not part of the veto message. The reason that our members are very eager to support this bill is that while perhaps cute, these furry little critters are very troublesome to our roads. And right now we have authority to take the dams when they're within 300 feet of the roadway. But, of course, anybody who knows anything about beaver knows if you take the dam and don't take the animal, They're homeless for two nights, and they rebuild. And then the road floods out, and we've got a tremendous erosion problem with our roads that ends up costing thousands of dollars in a course of a year for many of our townships. And so this bill simply allows us to take the beaver that are associated with the dam. When you take the dam out, you can take the beaver that are in the area with that dam within that same 300-foot restriction, so we're not going hog wild or expanding existing authority. It just allows us to take the beaver with the dam. With the amendment that was put on, the DNR actually helped us improve it to clarify that we still would go to the DNR and get an automatic permit from them. And that's just a housekeeping issue, so that if a conservation officer happens to come along, a town officer who's removing the beaver, we don't end up with a situation where they're cited for taking an animal and now there's a big battle over did you or did you not have authority. It just will save time and hassles for both sides. The last thing I want to say is that I did commit to the DNR. I know that bounties are not always favored. I point out that this is strictly optional. It is not a mandated part of the bill. It's just part of the control program. The town board or the road authority, this is for any road authority, would be required to consult with the DNR before adopting a control program. I think they'd be told by the DNR that bounties are not the best way to go. I think that we will be educating them that they don't work. And we may find some better language to narrow it down. But for now, everybody's comfortable with this version to give us authority to remove the animal and to work with the DNR in areas where there's an excessive problem on a control program.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for either one?
Mr. Chair, the DNR is available if anybody has any questions.
Members? Hearing none.
That, Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 358 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay? The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Anything else before the committee?
Seeing none.
Maybe, Mr. Chair, I could get a report from Senator Langseth on the flood control or flood report, meaning we do have a lot of time left. We're not used to getting done on time here, so let's is there anything most current?
Well, Mr. Chair, the real bad thing is the potential is really, really bad. One thing they're not factoring in is the fact that there isn't frost in the ground now. Last fall, there was just a few inches of frost. We got a snow cover, and it's thawed out up to the snow. The previous 2 years, they had about 2 or 3 feet of frozen mud. And so in the fall, it was just like having snow melt on concrete. And we've asked some of these people that are making the predictions if they've factored that in, and they said, no, they haven't. So I'm hoping that...
Is that good that, or that, bad?
Should be good.
Well, it's good that they haven't factored it in, because, you know, because it most likely is going to be helpful, and they haven't
be
either.
Helpful. Okay.
Because I think there's about, even though the ground is pretty moist, there's a good possibility an inch or two of moisture could go down. Yeah, right. But what we need from now on is thawing during the day and freezing at night. We just had 3 days of thawing here a while back, and a quarter of an inch of moisture went off in the air. But the potential is bad, but it might not be. But we're so much further along than we were even 2 years ago. I mean, we've spent a lot of money, and it's been very well spent, and those communities are protected.
Senator, in the past, and I don't recall, but maybe the committee would like to hear just exactly if this were to – well, it's not going to turn south. It's going to turn north there. If it does, would reports be coming to our committee fairly soon, or would it be just in general to the whole Senate body?
Well, I'm not sure. You can handle it any way you want to. We handle it mainly through the bonding committee. But there's two different aspects of it. One is prevention, which is the bonding. The other is the cleanup. And that requires cash money. That's the problem. But 75% of it does come from the federal government if there's a disaster designation. But so they usually are two different, in many cases, two different bills. But like I say, the one requires cash. And we won't know what that'll be until towards the end of session. the bonding thing, I have urged them to pass it early, because then we'll be able to take right off in the spring and begin work again. But, you know, from 1997 to 2009, there was a lot of money spent. But in 97, there was $4.5 billion worth of damage in the Red River Basin. A lot of that was up at Grand Forks and East Grand Forks. In 2009, the crest was higher, and the damage was a fraction of what it was.
That's a good thing.
So we got all our money back, yeah, and then some. Sure. And since 2009, just these 2 years, well, last year we spent $63.5 million. But it's come a long, long ways. And
that's good.
Well, that's a good report. And also, we're going to be looking at the southeast end of the state as well, I'm sure. So I guess we just have to say stay tuned. So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Without any further business, this meeting is adjourned.